Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Today is a very special episode because, as you undoubtedly know, sometimes podcasts like to tape in front of a live audience. Now, I was one of the organizers of my digital networking group, Mosaics, quote-unquote TinyCon, last night. It's like a one-night pop-up little networking event slash panels, and a lot of learning and drinks were had by all. I was moderating a panel featuring Raju Narasetty, the former CEO of Gizmodo, who has years of terrific experience underneath his belt, and Nat Garun, who is actually the senior tech editor at The Verge, and I was moderating them on the future of the news media, and like 6 minutes before the panel was about to begin, I asked Raju and Nat if they were okay if I recorded us, and they said yes. So when the audio begins, you're about to hear me let the entire audience know that they were surprised on the very first live episode of Future Proof. So without further ado, let's begin. Are all going to be at a live podcast taping, so you guys are on the next episode of Future Proof, so that is my show. So welcome, and feel free to clap if you want to. If you, okay. I'd love for both you guys to introduce yourselves, because you both have very different perspectives that you bring to this whole conversation. Raju?
Hi, Raju Narasetty. I'm a professor of journalism at Columbia Journalism School. I just started there until April. I was the CEO of the Gizmodo Media Group. And before that, News Corp, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post.
I don't know how to follow that up. I'm Nat Garun. I'm the tech editor at The Verge. We're a consumer technology news website. I run the tech section, which is basically our heart and soul and news operation there.
So I really wanted to, I think, start off because one thing I noticed that you have a lot that's different between both of you, but one thing that you have in common is you're both humans, and I think that one thing that we're all very much scared of right now in a lot of sectors is the, like, AI, and what role will that play in different sectors, particularly in the news sector. Do you think that there will be still a room for humans in this new economy? Obviously, we saw the news of the Daily News Unrelated today. What do you think AI means for the future of journalism and the news industry?
There's a lot of different uses that I think that AI is going to play in the news industry. Do I think that AI is going to replace reporters? No. They might replace, like, press releases, you know, like things that are less personality driven. But I think that, you know, like other media, like the ones that we try to strive for are the ones that have a soul to it. You know, like the writing that we do and the reporting that we do. There's things that robots can't do. They can't observe. They can't interview people and, like, notice, like, people's reactions or voice or tone or inflections. Those things are very important when we report and write and, you know, describe situations and, like, write our stories and put together a piece. So I think that that's one, in one respect, I don't think robots can replace that anytime soon.
Also, I think we talk about AI in terms of as though it's something that's coming, but I'll give you a couple of examples. At Reuters, they've been using AI since 2001 and have published about 8,000 articles based on AI. One of the things they do very well is there's an institute called the American Petroleum Institute, which reports oil production numbers every week, and it's very closely watched numbers. That whole thing that Reuters produces is machine-created content. Right? So they've been able to use that. They have an AI-based system called News Tracer that constantly looks at 700 million tweets to tell Reuters staff that something is becoming newsworthy. So they were able to beat every news company in the world with the San Bernardino shooter by like 7 minutes because of using AI. But the way they're thinking about using AI is to say it's a good way to look at big data and big numbers and big data sets and signal to a human that this is something you could. So give them a head start. I think that's a good way of thinking about where AI might be. Because AI can report a number, it doesn't tell you what it means, right? That will still require a human being for a long time to come.
And I think that there's some people who are hypothesizing, or even people working on now, the way that AI can help decipher fake news and surface that. Obviously, that's something that Facebook's working on, you know, maybe a little too late, but
Facebook's still not very good at it.
The important distinction, I think, about the whole having AI and relying on AI to moderate fake news or, you know, moderate any kind of content, I think it's important that, like, AI by itself doesn't have an opinion on whether something is, like, fake or whether something is appropriate or conservative or, you know, liberal or whatever. Like, someone is teaching it. Like, someone is building this machine learning, like, algorithm and model for this AI to learn about what it is. So, therefore, this AI is going to be as biased as the person who's creating it. So, like, it's important to remind ourselves that, like, this is a thing we keep harping about in terms of diversity in engineering and all these, like, companies like Facebook. If the people who are building these machines and algorithms aren't diverse and biased and are in a group that has a very mixed opinions and, like, representation of people, the AI is only going to be as biased as the people who are making it, which are going to be mostly maybe leaning liberal leaning or mostly white or mostly male. So, like, I think that's something to think about as well in terms of, like, this whole reliance on AI being the future of moderation.
That's true. And I think also there's a lot of innovation that's happening that is not AI related, even though it seems to dominate a lot of the discussions. I mean, one of the things I've been paying a lot of attention to is the fact that you have a lot of people who are consuming news in different ways than they did, you know, from years before. I mean, it can be RSS feeds. It can be even, you know, Alexa, tell me about so-and-so. And now you're actively searching for a specific type of news. And I'm wondering, you know, is that even going to impact how people actually report the news or what types of stories get covered?
It's already impacting it in the sense that digital has made everything a lot more multimedia, right? So as a result, you have to think about how do you engage audiences through not just words like we used to do in print a long time ago, with video, with increasingly audio, with also the ability to interact with news stories, right? Be able to comment and be able to respond. And so in that sense, I think it is already changing journalism. But what it isn't is the task of engaging somebody with a story that you think is important is still a journalistic task. It's just the means with which you engage is changing. And for the industry, I think it poses some interesting challenges, right? I mean, think of whether we may all disagree how many people will be in driverless cars over a period of time. But let's say 2% would be, right? If 2% of all the people driving in and out of New York from New Jersey and Connecticut are in, like, driverless cars, that means all of a sudden you've gained about 2 hours of their time to do lots of things with it, right? They can watch a movie, they can read something, or they can have the car read a story to them. So I think the way for media companies to think about it is if we believe that we are entering more of a hands-free world in the future, how do we kind of tap into that, and how do we make our brand or our journalism part of that ecosystem is a good way to frame it, rather than worry about is Alexa going to win or is Siri going to win or is some particular platform or technology is going to win, because those bets are hard to predict and you could lose a lot chasing one brand or platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think also, you just raised a really interesting point about the division of, it almost kind of makes me think about, like, the division of church and state, because now everybody is looking for certain types of content. And if there's, let's say, a native ad that shows up, I mean, just show of hands, has anybody else here ever read anything and realized afterwards that it was a native ad or advertorial of some sort? Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing that I think happens more and more, and is the traditional journalistic division of church and state kind of changing in some ways, where you have stories that aren't stories and ads that aren't ads?
I mean, I can only speak to the way we run things, which is that none of our core editorial teams write the advertorials at all. We have a separate team that does all of that. All we do is sign off on whether the content that is sold and is going to be on our site with, you know, our logo on it is of our tone, of something that we approve, of something that our audience that we believe would enjoy. And, like, you know, advertorials doesn't have to be, like, slimy. Like, I think that...
No, a lot of them are great. Yeah, like, it's almost like that's the problem, that they're so good that they can fool people.
Right. I mean, like, we sign off on making sure that the tone is right and that we believe that our audience would actually enjoy the piece of work that, you know, the team put together. We don't personally write them, but that's our separation. But we sign off on the tone, and we think that, you know, high-quality ads, yeah, again, don't have to be slimy. Like, as long as we think that they will serve our audience something, like, we'll work with it. Because, you know, like, that's just the reality. Like, media is ad-driven. Like, there's no escaping the fact that that's part of it.
And some of your roles have been kind of growth-driven, right? So you've been tasked with figuring out kind of, I mean, how closely have you followed just the whole entire world of the changing face of the ads that are placed next to these stories?
Look, I mean, advertising has always been next to stories, right? I mean, that's the only reason why advertising exists, because nobody goes out to particularly see ads alone. I think church and state was and is still a very good, valid principle for how journalism organizations are operated. But over time, what used to be church and state, I think, became church versus state. The newsrooms kind of basically said, we don't want to have anything to do with understanding how we make money. And as a result, practices kind of became ossified and proved kind of counterproductive to the financial success of the media companies. So I think organizations that have come in the last 10, 15 years that have a slightly redefined view of working together, I think have been a bit more successful and a lot of than the traditional media companies. End of the day, I think if journalists don't understand how the business operates, that actually is going to cause a lot more problems. And just as there is this notion in most newsrooms that most advertising people will sell their mother if they get a chance, because they never actually interact with them, right? They're kept so separate. So having them work together with some boundaries actually makes each other realize that people who sell advertising for a news brand actually have come to sell advertising for that news brand because they care about the journalism and the product, right? They're a very unique mm-hmm. salespeople. They really want to be in that business. And long term, if you mislead people, I mean, all the people who raise their hand about when they read something and they discovered it was an ad, actually it leaves a bad feeling. Right? It's not the right feeling you want to encourage with an advertising campaign. So in that sense, I think church and state is still valid, but I think they need to work together a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, as somebody who runs a marketing agency, I know the only reason why I wouldn't sell my mother is because I already did. So I think that's a...
If you get a good price, that's...
Oh, absolutely. You need a pretty decent ROI on that. But I mean, I think that... So one thing else I want to ask you guys is, one thing that I noticed is I feel like you guys both have a very strong journalistic background, but you both got into journalism in different years. And I think one thing that's really interesting to me is that the role of kind of like how a journalist goes about their day-to-day is probably got to be very different depending on when you enter, given the technologies that you have at your disposal. So I'm just maybe like starting with you, Nat, like what do you do? Like, what's a day in the life of trying to track down sources? And are there any particular technologies or platforms that you use in trying to manage your, you know,
sure.
journalistic
life? I think when I first started in the industry, which is about 7 years ago, most of my, the way I find news is just through RSS feeds. That was just sort of the way you get news. You get an RSS of press releases and maybe some, you know, your competitors to see what they're writing about, to get a list of, you know, company blogs to see what updates that you may or may not miss. That was basically the core. And then Twitter became a thing. So then you started following Twitter and different accounts, and now it's just constant stream of news that we're now sorting through. As the years grew, different, you know, technologies came out. Like, we used to have this thing called Page Monitor, which went sometimes we used to where I used to work at the Next Web in my last job, we used to do a lot of this reporting on, like, oh my god, this company is testing like a new feature, or you know, like, company code reveals that this feature is coming, or like, we were the first to break the blog about like some new feature coming, even though we may not have gotten the embargo on it, just because we use this thing called Page Monitor that will like ping us when a site changes. So like, if there's a new blog, it's like this site changed, like physically it looks different. So that would be like our fastest way to figure out that something has happened without getting the embargo. So that was like some of the technologies that we have nowadays. thankfully, I know more people now, so they tend to either work with me to try to get me news in advance, or we have, you know, better working relationships with some companies. But we still definitely do a lot of the whole, like, tracking down Reddit and Twitter and, like, just going through all these sources to uncover stuff that people are talking about. And, like you mentioned, there are tools like, you know, I think Twitter had, like, one called, like, News. I forget what it's called, but they had one similar to that where they aggregate a bunch of local tweets to try to figure out if a trending story or a trending news event is emerging.
I mean, to me, the biggest change is the pace at which journalism runs now is significantly faster than anybody ever imagined that it would be. And that has come from most of us becoming a lot more promiscuous in our ability to go anywhere we want, to consume whatever we want, right? If you, in the print days, you were captive to a geography. You may have, if you're lucky, if you're in New York, you had maybe five papers. But to read the Washington Post would have meant like a really difficult thing to do to get that, right? So you were confined to those five. So most journalists assumed that if something ran in their paper, a lot of people read it, and which is probably true. Right? But now all of us with the, you know, with a flick of a finger, a click of a button, by talking to our device, we can go read a story anywhere in the world.
Do you think it's turned, like, is all of this for the better, for the worse, or it's hard to say? Because I know if like, there was a cute Pomeranian on Jimmy Fallon and Kim Kardashian, you know, shares something about it, all of a sudden it might start to trend on Twitter, and then everybody's covering, like, you know, this Pomeranian you will not believe unless you look at it. Yeah. That would be a national story.
I think there's a positive and negative too, you know, as with all things. Like, the rate at which news and content spread can be good and bad, right? Like, fake news can spread very quickly, or misinformation can spread very quickly. At the same time, tools like, you know, like when Periscope was a thing and had a map view, like when you saw, like, that enabled people to literally go around the world and view things as they were happening. And that's a piece of reporting that we didn't have before whenever this app came out. So, like, that was useful to some respect. Like, I remember when the YouTube shooting happened a couple months ago, like, we went to Periscope and we went to, like, Snap Maps and try to look up the areas to see if there were any, like, emerging videos or footages of what was happening, just to try to confirm that that even occurred.
I mean, there's never been a larger audience for journalism in the history of journalism. In fact, since the invention of the 1450 Gutenberg press, than literally yesterday. It's going to be bigger today. It's going to be bigger tomorrow. The New York Daily News, which just cut its newsroom by half, has never had a larger audience for the New York Daily News than it had yesterday, if you combine their print and digital audience, right? So I think there's been a lot of, like, positive outcomes because of technology and the internet, that we are able to reach a lot more people. Different problem that we haven't been able to figure out how to make money and sustain it. But from a spread of journalism, our ability to, I mean, the New York Times, somebody mentioned earlier, 100 million uniques every month, right? In its heydays, it's the biggest ever print circulation was probably 1.5 million. Mm-hmm. So from a scale point of view, I think journalism has never had a bigger audience than ever. So I actually look at it as a positive sign.
But, you know, in some ways, and we were talking about this before, the idea of, I think, print journalism in some ways, you know, has a harder problem in trying to grow a digital base than, like, a digital first platform, because you're still beholden to the, you know, the print. You don't want to cannibalize on the thing that's going away, because it still is paying the bills, right?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest tragedy, depending on how you look at it, is that print hasn't died or isn't dying fast enough, right? So if you're running a Washington Post or a New York Times or a Wall Street Journal, 40 to 50% of your staff's time is still going towards creating this once-a-day platform. It's still making 40 to 50% of your revenue, and it's declining, but not at a pace at which, you know, you can shift all your resources into digital. So it's a real problem, and I think where this is going to really be a problem for us as a nation is most of our local press in this country still has a print component to it. And they're having the hardest time making the transition to digital, because local print is still a pretty significant ball and chain, if you will. So if we expect, like, local media in the U.S. to kind of somehow have a resurgence, I think it's only going to come from purely digital ventures. But the problem with that is that's going to take 10, 20 years to get to a scale at which a Denver Post even now is compared to a couple of startups in Denver. So it's a real issue.
Is it more, in some ways, an advantage to a more nascent publication like you guys that you can kind of pivot on a dime compared to some of the bigger entrenched players?
I mean, sure, of course, like being online and being able to access more amounts of people is great. The point about like local papers pivoting to online, though, like I think the issue there isn't just local papers needing to adapt to being on the internet. Like the people who struggle the most are probably the people where print newspaper is like the news media resource for a particular town. Like I think that like access to internet is still a very real problem in the U.S. that I think that those papers that are very meaningful to those communities, you know, like they're both the paper and the communities are struggling because they have limited access to internet. So there's like other issues there that they have to tackle and figure out before they can even think about growing into that kind of space. And, you know, we're in New York City, we don't have to worry about that, but there are real places that are still struggling with the whole access in the first place.
So, okay, 30 seconds each, and then I think we're going to maybe go to some questions. What is one thing that you either predict or are excited about the future of media? You know, something that you're following pretty closely now.
I have been, to my point about the whole, like, access to internet, I've been following a lot about the way apps are now shrinking. There's a lot of different like apps that are now light versions that are more data conscious and, you know, trying not to overwhelm you with notifications. I've been following that a lot because I find it very interesting the ways companies are trying to reach the people in areas where internet is limited and, you know, like access is difficult for them. So I've been following that a lot and just trying to figure out how they plan to, you know, how different companies try to access these people and try to deliver content information to those people who, you know, are still trying to get to where we are now.
I think in the next 18 months to 24 months, there's going to be a bit of a bloodbath among digital media companies for the simple reason that audiences are moving at such a rapid clip to mobile, which is at one level a good thing, but it is really upending the digital advertising and revenue model, because the amount of money you can make on a desktop home screen versus the amount of money you can make on a mobile home screen is like disproportionately small. And I don't think anybody has realized that this is a looming problem that is emerging very, very quickly, because most of us now have 60 to 70% of our audiences on mobile. But so desktop has become like print was to media companies, where it's a problem now, where you still make a lot of money on desktop, but it's so rapidly declining. And I don't think our industry has figured out what's the best way to monetize mobile. And I think that's going to be a real problem. It's going to hurt a lot of companies over the next 24 months.
Thank you guys so much. This is great. Thank you guys. And we still have the space for a little bit, so please, by all means, network, meet at least. And thank you so much, Raju. Thank you so much, Nat. And actually, you know, a big thank you to everybody who attended the TinyCon at NewsPix, which is a really great news aggregation and civil discourse app. So highly recommend you guys check out NewsPix as well. I'll throw that in the show notes. As always, you know, rate us and review us on Stitcher and Apple Podcasts, and be sure to listen to our back catalog of episodes if this is your first episode with us. Thank you again for joining us. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.